this is Long John with the Party Line. We're around from midnight to 5:36 mornings during the week. During that time, we have the pleasure of talking with many interesting people, and of course, on Mondays, we get started about 1, and we continue right through to 5:30. 37 and a half hours a week, talking with interesting people. I think some of you people remember that the other night, I mentioned on the program that we would be talking tonight to a gentleman who gave a lecture at the New York Center. And I'm referring to Arthur C. Clarke. Mr. Clarke is one of the world's foremost authorities on the subject of spaceflight. Mr. Clarke is a fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society and for 5 years was chairman of the British Interplanetary Society. He is a well-known author, and among his books are the following: Exploration of Space, Interplanetary Flight, Childhood's End, Against the Fall of Night, and Sands of Mars. I frankly do not know what Mr. Clarke's opinions may be as far as flying saucers are concerned, but I feel very confident that before we reach the hour of 5:30 that we'll know. And of course, our good friend Cortland Hastings is with us this morning, and Charles Leadham. Mr. Leadham is an author as well as a TV producer. The gentleman who I think will be of great interest to us tonight, as well as Mr. Clarke, is a gentleman by the name of Major Wayne S. Aho. Mr. Aho was on the program a few months ago, and I would like to mention at this time that Major Aho and Cortland Hastings will be giving a lecture at the New York Center Thursday, February 6th at 8 p.m. The address is 227 West 46th Street in the city of New York. Subject: what can you do about flying saucers? Now, Cort has been on the program many times. The Major's been with us once before. And no doubt many of our listeners who are interested in the subject of flying saucers will certainly want to attend that lecture. Again, let me remind you, it's Thursday, February 6th at 8 p.m., New York Center, 227 West 46th Street. Major Aho, he's going to give us some of his opinions tonight about flying saucers. And he also is going to give us the official statement of Major Donald E. Kehoe. I understand that in this statement, which will be read to us, we will learn, possibly for the first time, what actually happened on the night of the telecast of the Armstrong Circle Theater, January 22nd, over CBS. Later, I have been told, Major Aho will also tell us of newspaper and radio reports of sightings of flying saucers being seen overhead by audiences of Dr. George Hunt Williamson as they left the lecture halls in the various cities on the West Coast, during which one reporter not only witnessed it, but also took photos. And we have a lot of other interesting material for you this morning. Major Aho, since that Armstrong Circle Theater telecast, there's been a lot of stories going around about what happened. I don't want to know the facts at the moment, but I was just wondering, do you think when a person claims that they've seen a flying saucer, that they should be put into a mental hospital?
Well, John, I don't believe they should. If that is the case, why, there'd be thousands of our people in the world right today in mental institutions who have had these sightings all over the world. And if we went so far as putting the people that had these sightings, had these experiences in the hospital, then we'd no doubt have to hospitalize the witnesses also, because there are a number of witnesses in many of these reported sightings. That is something that I would just like to discuss at some length later this evening, and discuss the very interesting case of Reinhold Schmidt in Kearney, Nebraska, and bring to light everything that has happened up until now.
Do you believe the Schmidt story?
Well, let's put it this way, John. I wasn't there. I wasn't a witness. But I believe that the man's story has possibilities. And if his statement can be borne out that there were three or four other witnesses that saw this same ship, and the fact that these reported landings, these reports came from many parts of the nation. I have with me some news this evening about a similar type of landing story from Long Beach, California. And when you add that to the Loveland, Texas incidents, and White Sands, New Mexico, and Nashville, Tennessee, and the fact that these are all occurring about the same day with no relationship between them. The parties did not know each other, and they occurred almost simultaneously. Then we should begin to consider that perhaps the Reinhold Schmidt story did have some merit.
Just because you've heard a lot of other stories, Major Aho, you feel that there's a possibility that the Schmidt story is true.
Well, John, I have I've received several letters from Reinhold Schmidt. I am aware that that right today he's back at the scene of operations. Many people know that he was sent to a mental institution in Hastings, Nebraska, which I think we should discuss at some length when you want to go into that part of the program.
He's out though now.
He's out, and he claims to have passed every test he demanded, according to his letter, every test they could give him, and he passed these tests. And the same company that had sent him originally to Kearney, Nebraska as a grain buyer put him right back in Kearney, Nebraska, still in their employ. So apparently some people have faith in the man.
I spoke the other day to the newscaster who's with the Mutual Broadcasting System in Kearney, Nebraska. Actually, he called me, and he was in the hotel room with Mr. Schmidt at the time. And he was under the impression that I had made an announcement, that as Schmidt heard through somebody else, that I had made an announcement on this program that I knew that there were witnesses to the story. Well, I hadn't said that. And evidently, Mr. Schmidt had the idea that possibly I would know the names and addresses of these additional witnesses, alleged witnesses. And frankly, I do not know them. I know nothing about it. Court?
Yeah, I wanted to add one small addendum there, John. I understand that one of the... very short one.
Thank you.
One of the eminent citizens of that town was a witness to this very thing. But because of the ridicule which was heaped upon it, and the great amount of censure and opprobrium, he considered it much better for the safety of his own skin and the safety of his own reputation to remain incognito. But he told individuals that he had seen it, but refused to let his name be used.
I don't want to know the source of your information, but may I just ask you this. Is this hearsay?
Probably not. Mm-hmm. I wasn't there either, John, so I can't say, but I would say the source was quite reliable.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we get into our discussion with the other guests this morning, let me take a moment to talk about this offer. You heard the statement that was made by Major Aho a moment ago. And I was just wondering, as an astronomer, and also I understand that you were 5 years chairman of the British Interplanetary Society,
I think with that background, you possibly have some opinion about the possibility of saucers being interplanetary.
Yes, I think it's only a matter of time before we're visited from space. In fact, I had an article in Harper's Magazine about 3 or 4 months ago called Where's Everybody?, which was on this very theme. There are at least 100,000 million suns in this one universe of ours, and we're probably a pretty backward section of it. And we've only been civilized, if we are civilized, for a very short period of time. I'm sure there'll be thousands of civilizations out there among the stars with very much higher standards than ours, and they have space travel and interstellar travel. So it's certainly only a matter of time before we're visited.
Now, when you say, Mr. Clark, it's only a matter of time, are you implying that possibly they haven't arrived here as yet?
I should think it's very probable they've arrived scores of times in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And it's even possible they've arrived in historic time. I mean, since there have been men who've recorded these things. I mean, some of Charles Fort's accounts are very hard to explain any other way except the arrival of spaceships in the Earth's atmosphere. But I don't think they're arriving now.
You don't think they're arriving now? When
No.
you say that, do you mean today?
Well, I mean, I don't think they've arrived.
Or during the last
months? In the last, during the century, say.
During the century.
Mm-hmm.
You don't feel that any saucers or UFOs have arrived here from other planets?
Of course, I can't prove this, but
mm-hmm.
it's my feeling that they haven't arrived. I mean, on the basis of all the evidence
that's been unearthed. If you feel that they have arrived here from time to time from other planets, why is it that they have stopped during the past century?
Well, I don't say they've stopped, but the problem is this. Suppose you have to conduct a survey of 100,000 million suns.
Mm-hmm.
You have only a limited number of survey ships. Well, with a very rough estimate, you could probably only survey any one system every few thousand or few million years. And I should suggest that somewhere in some enormous central filing system will be a file on Earth with various interesting information about it, a few thousand years out of date, saying that this planet may be worth visiting in, say, what might be the year 5000 A.D. to us. And they'll work around for us again sooner or later.
I'm a little speechless at this time. Charles?
Yes. Well,
are you going home?
I'm going to go look for this file card, to tell you the truth. The thing that curiosifies me is this. Why must they have come, say, in Paleolithic times, and why couldn't it have been, you know, 2 weeks ago last Monday that they brought the file card up to date?
Well, it could be any time. I'm just pointing out the statistics of it. Earth has been here for, let's say, 5 billion years, take a nice round figure, roughly 5 billion years.
Not 4 billion.
Well, let's take the five. I like nice round numbers. 5 billion. We've been here, let's say, as a roughly civilized race for perhaps 5,000 years, one millionth of that total time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the chances of anything coming along in that period of time are fairly small. Now, as to why I don't think there are any visitors from space as of now, if somebody tells me they have seen a unicorn in Central Park, I say, very interesting, you may be right. If there really is a unicorn in Central Park, there will be no doubt whatsoever about the matter in a very short period of time. Similarly, if there really are spaceships hovering around this Earth, that is the sort of thing which will be settled as unequivocally as the existence of unicorns in Central Park in a very short period of time. They'll be tracked, photographed, observed in every possible way.
Well, Arthur, I personally do not buy the flying saucer thing, but I think there's an angle of motivation here. The unicorn in Central Park, I doubt, would much care whether or not he was established. But if our file keepers from Planet X want to do an anonymous survey, well, then they might, you know, very well keep out of the way most of the time, but they might slip a few times and a few gentlemen might see them.
Yes, but if they slipped at all, there wouldn't be much doubt about that. That's not the sort of thing that you can keep quiet. I mean, it's like the girl who said that her baby was a very small one. I mean, this is an all-or-nothing operation.
Sure enough. That I cannot fight.
Arthur Clark,
on this program, I've had the pleasure and the opportunity of talking with a lot of people, and I would say I've spoken to at least, oh, 8 or 10 people who claim that they have had physical contact with Venusians and Martians, and if I'm not mistaken, 2 or possibly 3 of these people claim that they've been in saucers and they've visited other planets. How do you feel about those things, Mr. Clark?
Well, all these people who claim to have had physical contact and to have actually ridden in space vehicles,
mm-hmm.
they fall into 3 categories. Some of them are fooling you.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them really believe it and are insane. Others are possibly hoaxed by other people.
And there are no, somebody is fooling.
They have someone may have fooled someone of rather simple intelligence may have been fooled by some unscrupulous friends who could possibly have kidded them into thinking they had met someone from a flying saucer. I'm sure that has happened occasionally.
Well, I'd be interested to meet the man who could bring down this, you know, 60-foot pulsating object through the sky to fool some of these people.
Well,
this is the guy I want to get in contact with.
Well, I'm not discussing any particular case. I'm just generalizing.
Cortland?
I take it that Mr. Clark feels an impossibility for somebody to have a physical contact. Is that right, Mr. Clark?
It's a possibility. It'll happen sooner or later. The point is, when it happens, there'll be no doubt about it.
Well, why do you say that?
Because this sort of thing does not happen in out-of-the-way places to obscure people.
Well, if you say it's never happened before, how can you make a statement that it won't happen in out-of-the-way places?
Because it'll happen, if it does happen even in an out-of-the-way place, that place will not remain out of the way very long.
Well, what would bring it in out of the way?
Pardon?
What would bring it in out of the way?
Well, listen, let's speak. Suppose that there is someone, say a reconnaissance group, surveying this planet, which, as I said, is quite possible, and I think ultimately is a certainty. Well, now, what will their procedure? If they're anthropologists, they'll make contact with people, and they'll work up from that. But the sort of reports we've had so far are so unconvincing and so trivial, and they're so contradictory. I don't see how you can possibly take any basis of seriousness in them.
Mr. Clark, I'm interested in the statement that you just made, that you feel that the flying saucers would not contact an obscure person. Is that right, sir?
Oh, no. They wouldn't. For instance, all the reports I've said, well, most of the people who have claimed to have made contact with flying saucers,
mm-hmm.
The fact they're obscure has nothing to do with it. But they're, let's say, also peculiar, many of them. And I don't think you can deny that. Now, I'm not going to give any names, but I think you can fill in the blanks quite easily yourselves.
Well, no, I'd like to get back to... Didn't you use the word obscure?
I did use that word, and what I will ratify it. They might make contact, first of all, with, say, anybody they came up against. But, you know, that little famous cartoon, Take Me to Your President,
mm-hmm.
that's the sort of thing that will happen very soon after they have made contact with anybody.
I'm interested in your thinking on this, Mr. Clark. You made a statement a little while ago that you thought that possibly saucers or UFOs or spacecraft, that is, interplanetary craft, had arrived on this planet, but possibly not for the past 100 years. Now, if this is true, and let us say that 150 years ago, some interplanetary craft landed on this planet and they accidentally contacted an obscure person, don't you think that that person would have taken the Venusians or the Martians to somebody of importance so that we would have a record of it in our history?
I think that's very likely, and that is one of the best arguments against this happening in historic times. So you have fairly well convinced me that it hasn't happened for this reason. Your argument is a very sound one.
So we might as well wrap it up for a night.
No, that would be most disappointing. We can go back to, say, about 2000 BC, and then what would have happened? It would have been lost. I mean, the whole
That's
historical...
True.
Well, the point is,
hasn't been, actually.
Yes, but there's very little point in discussing these cases because you can never prove them one way or the other, the early cases. They can never be proved. You can argue around them till kingdom come. And there's no way that I can see, unless you make a time machine, of proving that that really was an extraterrestrial contact. So we are really stuck with the modern sightings if we want to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Cortland?
As long as we're back to 2000 B.C., which is a rather interesting and round date.
I like round figures.
Sure. A friend of mine is an Egyptologist, and he's been doing quite a bit of study in that. And he says that in the Book of the Dead, there are numerous references to spaceships or machines from space. There is some reference to sun, and some people say that these are suns. But in the next paragraphs or so, it will be mentioned that these machines blot out the sun. And there are numerous references to the pharaohs going out to have conversations with these people as being those beings from outer space of greater wisdom than our own.
Well, I mean, I could match dozens of these cases from... Yeah, you can take things in the Bible. I mean, you can prove thousands of cases, quite convincing, but you could not prove them, but you can build up some very interesting cases, but you can never prove them or disprove them, so really there's not much you can do on the matter.
The thing that, surprises me is that so much credence is attached to Egyptian mythology. Why not go into Norse mythology and talk about Valhalla and the ice gods and so forth as being, who knows, maybe frozen flying saucers? What is so... You know, what is so much with Egypt in the Book of the Dead? This is what I don't understand.
Well, some very good cases in the Ceylonese mythology. I happen to live in Ceylon now, and there are cases in the sacred writings of Ceylon going back to about 500 B.C., where there are stories of flying machines and so on, which are quite convincing.
Well, the Book of the Dead is an extremely important book. It happens to be one of the bases. That's why I was referred to. I'd like to go back, however, to the point of actual contact here of much more contemporary nature than 2000 B.C. That is a little bit long. I would like to mention, or go back, say, to 1947, in which the Army Air Force intelligence officers had been investigating reports of unidentified flying objects at very high speeds in various sections of the United States. And on September 23rd, and in fact on July 8th, the Air Corps statement at the Pentagon is, and I quote, "We are investigating a flying disc report by Navy rocket engineer C.T. Zome and three other rocket scientists." Now, we assume that these rocket scientists would know a UFO from something with which they were familiar. And on September 23rd of 1947, the official analysis report from the Air Technical Intelligence Center, that's where we investigate these things, Mr. Clark, out at the Air Force base in Dayton, Ohio, to General Hoyt Vandenberg, who incidentally was a friend of my superior and a very close one, commanding general at that time of the Army Air Corps, and I quote, "The reported phenomena are real," end quote. Now, there is no question there as to what they're thinking. Those words are incisive.
I think there's a great deal of question as to what they're thinking. They say the reported phenomena are real, end quotes, and anything beyond that is what you read into it and is subject to a lot of question.
They mean that they are real, that they are not anything that we have, Charles, and that they obviously are coming from outer space.
Portland, how do you know what they mean?
Because I am about to read 1948.
Good, this is what I would like to know.
You did that great. That was a good production. Thanks, Charles. You're a good end man here.
Yeah, you're a good middleman, too, Courtney.
The Air Corps in 1948, July 24th, a statement by General George C. Kenney, who was at that time chief of the Strategic Air Command, after the so-called spaceship sighting by the pilots and a passenger of an Eastern Airlines plane, stated, "We're completely mystified. We have nothing remotely like the machine described. I wish we did," end quote.
That doesn't mean that they're interplanetary, though, Clark. They may be from a foreign government.
It doesn't even mean they're machines.
It says we have, all he said is we have nothing remotely like what was described by the witnesses, which means absolutely nothing to me.
In August, the date was withheld, but a top secret estimate of the situation by the Air Technical Intelligence Center, later declassified but never released, stated that flying saucers were interplanetary spaceships.
What was that again?
Flying saucers.
Now, who said that?
A top secret estimate of the situation. This is a document.
Declassified,
but not released.
Do you realize that recently, I think it was just today, they were declassified a document on the use of bows and arrows in warfare, which was classified by mistake, Mr. Hastings? A lot of this top secret classified secret estimate, which may have been by a corporal and a demented corporal at that, is not very impressive.
I'm not trying to impress by whether it was classified or declassified.
Oh, I see. Well, what is the impressive part?
It was never released.
That is the impressive part of this statement. We've been leading up with my end man bit here for 5 minutes to this statement. Now, what is the impressive part of it?
Well, I guess I don't speak good English.
No.
It said the flying saucers were interplanetary spaceships.
And this, as far as I know, this was made by a demented corporal at Dayton, Ohio. Now, how do you know any different?
No, it was made by a rather higher level than that. It was made by a number of quite competent authorities who had access to the information and who came to this conclusion, as I think many reasonable men would do, if their knowledge of atmospheric optics and natural phenomena was not complete.
Then you're kind of go along with Dr. Menzel of Harvard.
Oh, no, I don't go along entirely with him, but most of the confusion in this subject is caused by mixing up two entirely separate things. One, UFOs. I think UFOs probably exist. And the other, so-called flying saucers, which are our vehicles, definite vehicles, which are a totally different thing, and which don't exist.
Flying saucers are different from UFOs, and according to your opinion, Mr. Clark, flying saucers do not exist, but there's a great possibility that UFOs do.
I would say that there's a 99% possibility that UFOs do exist, and a 1%, and only a 1% possibility that flying saucers as interplanetary vehicles exist.
Well, Mr. Clark, I wonder if you could tell me what a UFO is.
Well, let me go back to this report of these gentlemen who decided...
The one that Cortland
has
talking about?
Decided, in view of the fact, these reports and this evidence, that these things were really interplanetary vehicles. This is a conclusion I came to myself about that time as a result of these reports. And it wasn't until I'd seen about six UFOs myself that I decided that I realized they were not spaceships. The point is that there are far more fantastic things in the sky than anybody realizes, even a trained observer who spends a lot of time looking at the sky. And I don't see how anyone hearing all these reports and not seeing them could really fail to think they were spaceships, but they're not spaceships when you were to analyze the evidence. Now, let me give my reasons for thinking this. First of all, as I say, I heard all these reports, these sightings, made by competent people, and I mean, you couldn't say they were all lying. And they were very convincing and very extraordinary and very inexplicable. And then, as I traveled around the world, I've been around the world a couple of times in the last 5 years, I saw quite a few strange things. And I have now seen, I've just been listing them, I have seen six UFOs. By that I mean objects which were quite inexplicable when I saw them, which could easily have been interpreted as spaceships, which took a lot of explaining, and often the explanations were so fantastic I almost hesitate to give them. But in every case I was able to find out what they were. But I'm sure that 99% of people who had seen them would have decided they were spaceships, but they were not. But this is happening all the time. Now, can I give some examples of things I saw to show you what I mean?
Please do.
Well, I was in London one day on bright summer's day, somewhere near Regent Street, and I saw a lot of people looking up at the sky. And I looked up too. And there, a long way up, were two black spheres close together, quite motionless in the sky. There was a very strong wind blowing at the time, and these two black discs or spheres just were absolutely motionless over the center of London. I will come back to this in a minute. I'll go on to my next sighting. I was in Brisbane, Australia, on my first underwater expedition to the Great Barrier Reef. And one evening, I was in a building about 5 or 6 floors up, looking out towards the sunset, and I saw, to my astonishment, a whole string of brilliant silver discs, roughly elliptical, flip-flopping across the horizon quite slowly with a curious oscillating movement. And I said, good heavens, this is it, you see. And I watched them go right across the sky, and this was absolutely convincing, these oscillating silver discs moving slowly. Well, that was the second case. I'll give you a third case before I come back to the earlier two, if you don't mind me taking so much of your time. Again, I was in Australia, in Sydney, and I saw an extraordinarily shaped cloud. It looked like a cloud, except it had rather solid edges, hanging above the city of Sydney. And this again was a strong wind blowing, and this cloud stayed in the same place and slightly altered its shape, but it looked like an amoeba. It was hanging over Sydney, and despite the fact there was a very strong wind blowing. But I've given these three things, and I'd like to know if you... I'll tell them to you. Can you explain them? I'll tell you what they were in a minute, but these were the things I saw. I'm describing them as carefully as I can.
Would you care to try?
The two black discs in a high wind of motionless over the middle of London, the string of silver ellipses flip-flopping across the sky along the horizon, and this weird amoeba-shaped cloud, motionless in a high wind over the middle of the great city.
No, these sound like regular descriptions.
Quite, well...
Fine sausage.
And I mean,
I'd like to hear what you...
If anyone had told me they had seen these things, I would have been forced to accept them as inexplicable flying, so as perhaps some kind of artifact. Well, the first one was an artifact. The two black discs close together high over London. If I hadn't gone to Regent's Park, I wouldn't have found out what it was. It was a kid flying a very large box kite that must have been about a mile up. But it was so high that its structure was... You couldn't see what it was, and of course you don't associate kite flying in the middle of London, but it was a box kite at such a height that it looked like two black spots side by side over the middle of London.
Was a box kite.
I went to Regent's Park and saw the kid flying it.
You saw the...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it was a high... I've never seen a kite so high. I mean, I say about a mile up, that's a rough guess, but you could not tell it was a kite because it was so high. Now, this is, you may say, a simple case, but this is the sort of thing that can start reports, right?
Mm-hmm.
I am almost ashamed to tell you what the flipping discs were, because this sounds so trite, and I had read this in books and I had not believed it. They were seagulls catching the setting sun. Now listen, before you laugh at me, I was born by the sea. I have lived by the sea nearly all my life. I live by the sea now. I have seen seagulls a million times, but only once in my life have I seen this phenomenon. Under certain conditions of illumination with a low sun, seagulls and other birds produce an absolutely convincing impression of metallic discs moving, oscillating across the sky. That was what this was. Now, the third case, this amoeba-shaped cloud, motionless over a city in a high wind, slowly changing its shape, it was a weird thing. It really sort of gave me creeps. I had to get a pair of binoculars to find out what it was. And there was a chemical plant of some kind with a high chimney, which I couldn't see, and some fumes, I don't know what they were coming out of this chimney. You couldn't see them when they left the chimney, as you can't see the smoke, as you often can't see the steam from a kettle. And it was obviously condensing a little way downwind of the chimney and then being dispersed. So it was roughly motionless in space, despite the wind, and it was slowly changing its shape. It was an artificial cloud, a byproduct of this chemical factory. Well, all these three cases are just examples of some of the extraordinary things that I myself have seen in a few years in the sky. And this is why I don't take seriously any report of anything seen in the sky. I'm sure that people see these things, they can't interpret them.
Arthur, you mentioned UFOs and flying saucers. You believe in UFOs and you don't believe in flying saucers. Isn't it possible that because you have never seen a flying saucer, or at least to your knowledge, you don't know that you saw an interplanetary craft? I call them flying saucers because it's convenient on this program. If you've never seen one, and yet you believe in UFOs, Isn't it possible for a person to see a flying saucer and not being familiar with its shape or the anything about it that they could be considered to be UFOs?
Of course, it's perfectly possible. When there's so many hundreds of explanations of strange things, why on earth bring in an unearthly explanation until we've exhausted all the terrestrial ones?
We've talked on this program to a few members of an organization that's called CSI, that's Civilian Saucer Intelligence. It's located in the city of New York. And I might say that the few people that I've had the pleasure of meeting who are members of that organization are certainly brilliant, intelligent people, people that have excellent educational backgrounds, people like Lex Mebane, Ted Blocher, Ivan Sanderson. These names may mean nothing to you at all. Oh, you know Ivan. I heard recently, not from these gentlemen, but from other people, and so far no one has denied it, that a few of these people, not all of the names that I've mentioned, but a few of them, believe in little men, not green ones now. In other words, actually, it's been thrown out on this program by somebody that these men believe in little green men. Now, that has been corrected, not by Mr. Mebane or Mr. Blocher, but we've had people who said it isn't green one. They don't even know what the colors may be. But due to extensive research on the part of one or two members of Civilian Saucer Intelligence, these people now sort of lean in the direction of the little men visiting this planet. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's nonsense. I mean, there's no evidence for these things, and why bring them in until you've explained, until you've eliminated all the other possibilities?
Mm-hmm. Court?
I don't think that...
You're almost speechless at this moment.
Oh, no, I'm not. I'm just waiting patiently.
I see.
I'm sorry if I'm being monopolized.
Not at all. Arthur, this program here, you're liable to go for an hour without stopping. That's the way we work this program.
Frankly, I think Mr. Clark is to be complimented on his examining into the what he saw.
I agree with you.
I am all for that. I think there is too little of it. We need more of it. But I don't think that what your experience, Mr. Clark, is any indication of the grand total. I have seen things, too, which looked like saucers. I didn't think so, but I wasn't sure. But in a few minutes, I determined very definitely that there would have to be much more solidity to what I saw to prove to me that they were saucers. And I have never seen one, yet. As far as the little men go, I'm sure Ivan Sanderson feels quite convinced in his own mind after having gone down to the... wherever that blooming place was, where the landing was supposed to have been.
Are you talking about the West Virginia Monster?
Well, he went down that Flatwoods,
yes.
West
yes,
Virginia.
Flatwoods, yeah. West Virginia.
Yeah, but
that wasn't a little man.
I was just trying to think of the location, but I don't feel so bad, Long John, as long as your memory, which is as long as an elephant, can't remember where it was.
I may have made a mistake here. Ivan Sanderson is not Hans Stefansson, the...
Ivan Sanderson is the zoologist.
Oh, I don't know
him. Hans Stefan Sanderson is the editorial director of Fantastic.
Yes, I know Hans quite well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Ivan is a very bright chap and very well grounded. And I heard him give a dissertation one evening on these little men. As far as I'm concerned, I put it aside because I don't know whether there are or not. I certainly would credit Ivan's intelligence quite considerably because when he goes after something, he's a bit skeptical on these things. Let's say he's very skeptical about them. However, what I wanted to get back to is to some of these. If Mr. Clark feels that there are no saucers which have been around lately, I would like to just bring out a whole battery of instances here, not consecutively, because after all, that would be taking too much time. But on November 3rd, I presume you're aware, Mr. Clark, that there were quite a concentration of sightings. They started, actually, on November 2nd. On November 2nd, the owner of station KCLV in New Mexico saw a strange glowing object speeding southeast. Now, he could have been mistaken, no question. But the Ground Observer Corps at Midland, Texas, logged reports of a large bluish object flying west at a low altitude. And that same evening, Civilian Aeronautics Association, is that correct, Wayne? You're up on that CAA? Tower operators on duty at the Amarillo Airport base sighted a peculiar bluish object moving through the sky. And one of the tower operators, whose business it is to know these things, said he had never seen anything so spectacular. Well, that's another one. Now, however, we get to the things that are going to be more concrete and where we can really sink some teeth in. At 1:30 on November 3rd, on a Sunday, a huge oval-shaped object was reported as landing, or very closely approaching trucks, on a highway in Levelland, Texas, or right outside of Levelland, Texas. Now, the sheriff investigated these cases, and in three of them, the close passage of the UFO had stopped the car engines and dimmed or put out the headlights. Now, two other men, Clem himself, the sheriff, and his deputy sheriff, saw the glow from the object themselves as it crossed above the highway and brilliantly lighted up the pavement. And this light was seen by two other patrolmen, each following in a separate car. Now, would you care to comment on that before I go to into some others?
Yes.
They saw the object as 125 to 200 feet in diameter, I might add.
Well, now, this boils down to a number of separate categories. First of all, the sightings, the objects seen in the sky, those are quite different from what I was talking about in flying saucers and vehicles. They're what I call the UFOs, and many of those may be an unexplained UFO. I'd like to come back to that later. But before, let me recapitulate. Anything strange seen in the sky, not close enough to get you to give an idea of its structure, that may have many hundreds of separate explanations, and I think there may be a residue which has no explanation yet. You can call this a genuine UFO, which may turn out to be quite a new phenomenon. I have some ideas on that I'd like to come to later. But now, as for the reports of things that land and come down to Earth, people see things coming out of them, I just do not believe any of those. And this one contains, this one you have just quoted, contains the seeds of its own disproof. The story of the car engine stopping, because this brings me right back to 1937. In 1937-1938, car engines were stopping all over England. They were stopping near the big towers that had been put up along the East Coast, because those towers were supposed to contain a ray, to generate a ray, which would stop the engines of the Luftwaffe when they bombed England. And this report, every week you were hearing about car engines being stopped. Everybody believed this, quite genuinely, that car engines were being stopped. This was absolute nonsense. They were radar stations, and the car engine reports were being put out by counterintelligence to make people think that this is what these stations really were, that they were to stop the Luftwaffe's engines. There was no truth whatsoever in these reports, but this was a universal belief. So whenever I hear about car engines stopping, I remember the same thing 20 years ago, and there was not a word of truth in it.
Well, do you feel then that it's possible that our government are putting out these false rumors?
There's no need to make false rumors, but no need to put them out.
Well, these had nothing to do with radar towers, Mr. Clark.
No, but this is a beautiful example of the sort of hysteria that generates. Someone starts a story, and quite possibly someone sees something and they stole their engine. And then that starts the whole thing.
And then they put out the headlights, too.
Sure. They probably pulled the ignition out.
Well, we'll have to go to another one where there are a great many more cars involved.
Well, before we do that, let me take a moment to do a little piece of business. I think you wanted to get into a little different line.
Yeah, I was, now that we proved that flying saucers don't exist, I thought, one point, Arthur, in your lecture the other night at the New York Center, you said something about satellites. You said quite a lot about satellites, for that matter. But one thing was, I recall you saying that if the Russians on their satellite had used instead of the on the second satellite, instead of the big dog bearing thing, if they had put a fourth stage on there, they could have hit the moon. Is that
yes, they could have landed. They could have hit the moon with a payload of about 50 pounds, maybe 100 pounds.
Why would they? Having got one satellite up already, I don't know whether the second one was really for scientific research or what, but it certainly would have been a great deal more impressive if they had done a magnesium flare or whatever they're going to do to mark the moon.
Well, what they did with Sputnik 2 was much more useful scientifically. That was loaded with instruments, and of course, as well as a dog, and they obtained a vast amount of scientific information from that flight. So that was the obvious next one to do after Sputnik 1, to do the heavier payload in the orbit. I would say the logical thing now for the next one is an attempt to shoot something around the moon. They can do it any time they feel like it, but I'm rather surprised they haven't already.
What value would it be for any country to be able to land on the moon?
What value would it to land on America? The moon is much bigger than America, and after all, the moon is only the stepping stone to the other planets and to the universe as a whole.
Do you think it would be of any value to us in the event of war as a nation?
No, I don't think so. We can destroy ourselves completely adequately with existing weapons on this planet. There's no need to go into space to set up military bases.
I agree with Mr. Clark. First time this evening. It's a pleasure, sir.
But if we want to use the moon for any military purpose, I suggest we build our air raid shelters there.
What? I wanted to get back to this other little corroborating instance, because I frankly, Mr. Clark, with due deference to your scientific knowledge, which is vastly in excess of mine, I wanted to point out another sighting, however, of a UFO by a research engineer of the Air Force Missile Development Center near Alamogordo.
This is Long John with the Party Line. We're around from midnight to 5:36 morning during the week. During that time, we have the pleasure of talking with many interesting people, and of course, on Mondays, we get started about 1, and we continue right through to 5:30. 37 and a half hours a week talking with interesting people. I think some of you people remember that the other night I mentioned on the program that we would be talking tonight to a gentleman who gave a lecture at the New York Center. And I'm referring to Arthur C. Clarke. Mr. Clarke is one of the world's foremost authorities on the subject of spaceflight. Mr. Clarke is a fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society and for 5 years was chairman of the British Interplanetary Society. He is a well-known author, and among his books are the following: Exploration of Space, Interplanetary Flight, Childhood's End, Against the Fall of Night, and Sands of Mars. I frankly do not know what Mr. Clark's opinions may be as far as flying saucers are concerned, but I feel very confident that before we reach the hour of 5:30 that we'll know. And of course, our good friend Cortland Hastings is with us this morning, and Charles Leadham. Mr. Leadham is an author as well as a TV producer. The gentleman who I think will be of great interest to us tonight, as well as Mr. Clark, is a gentleman by the name of Major Wayne S. Aho. Mr. Aho was on the program a few months ago, and I would like to mention at this time that Major Aho and Cortland Hastings will be giving a lecture at the New York Center Thursday, February 6th at 8 p.m. The address is 227 West 46th Street in the city of New York. Subject: What can you do about flying saucers. Now, Court has been on the program many times. The Major's been with us once before. And no doubt many of our listeners who are interested in the subject of flying saucers will certainly want to attend that lecture. Again, let me remind you, it's Thursday, February 6th at 8 p.m., New York Center, 227 West 46th Street. Major Aho, he's going to give us some of his opinions tonight about flying saucers. And he also is going to give us the official statement of Major Donald E. Kehoe. I understand that in this statement, which will be read to us, we will learn, possibly for the first time, what actually happened on the night of the telecast of the Armstrong Circle Theater, January 22nd, over CBS. Later, I've been told, Major Aho will also tell us of newspaper and radio reports of sightings of flying saucers being seen overhead by audiences of Dr. George Hunt Williamson as they left the lecture halls in the various cities on the West Coast, during which one reporter not only witnessed it, but also took photos. And we have a lot of other interesting material for you this morning. Major Aho, since that Armstrong Circle Theater telecast, there's been a lot of stories going around about what happened. I don't want to know the facts at the moment, but I was just wondering, do you think when a person claims that they've seen a flying saucer, that they should be put into a mental hospital?
Well, John, I don't believe they should. That is the case, why there'd be thousands of people in the world right today in mental institutions who have had these sightings all over the world. And if we went so far as putting the people that had these sightings, had these experiences in the hospital, then we'd no doubt have to hospitalize the witnesses also, because there are a number of witnesses in many of these reported sightings. That is something that I would just like to discuss at some length later this evening, and discuss the very interesting case of Reinhold Schmidt in Kearney, Nebraska, and bring to light everything that has happened up until now.
Do you believe the Schmidt story?
Well, let's put it this way. John, I wasn't there. I wasn't a witness. But I believe that the man's story has possibilities. And if his statement can be borne out that there were three or four other witnesses that saw this same ship, and the fact that these reported landings, these reports came from many parts of the nation. I have with me some news this evening about a similar type of landing story from Long Beach, California. And when you add that to the Loveland, Texas incidents, and White Sands, New Mexico, and Nashville, Tennessee, and the fact that these are all occurring about the same day with no relationship between them, the parties did not know each other, and they occurred almost simultaneously, then we should begin to consider that perhaps the Reinhold Schmidt story did have some merit.
Just because you've heard a lot of other stories, Major Aho, you feel that there's a possibility that the Schmidt story is true?
Well, John, I've received several letters from Reinhold Schmidt. I am aware that that right today he's back at the scene of operations. Many people know that he was sent to a mental institution in Hastings, Nebraska, which I think we should discuss at some length when you want to go into that part of the program.
He's out, though, now.
He's out, and he claims to have passed every test he demanded, according to his letter, every test they could give him, and he passed these tests. And the same company that had sent him originally to Kearney, Nebraska as a grain buyer put him right back in Kearney, Nebraska, still in their employ. So certainly some people have faith in the man.
I spoke the other day to the newscaster who's with the Mutual Broadcasting System in Kearney, Nebraska. Actually, he called me, and he was in the hotel room with Mr. Schmidt at the time. And he was under the impression that I had made an announcement, that if Schmidt heard through somebody else, that I had made an announcement on this program, that I knew that there were witnesses to the story. Well, I hadn't said that. And evidently, Mr. Schmidt had the idea that possibly I would know the names and addresses of these additional witnesses, alleged witnesses. And frankly, I do not know them. I know nothing about it. Court?
Yeah, I wanted to add one small addendum there, John. I understand that
what
one
size?
Of these... very short one.
Thank you.
One of the eminent citizens of that town was a witness to this very thing. But because of the ridicule which was heaped upon it, and the great amount of censure and opprobrium, he considered it much better for the safety of his own skin and the safety of his own reputation to remain incognito. But he told individuals that he had seen it, but refused to let his name be used.
I don't want to know the source of your information, but may I just ask you this. Is this hearsay?
Probably not. Mm-hmm. I wasn't there either, John, so I can't say, but I would say the source was quite reliable.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we get into our discussion with the other guests this morning, let me take a moment to talk about this offer. You heard the statement that was made by Major Ahole a moment ago. And I was just wondering, as an astronomer, and also I understand that you were 5 years chairman of the British Interplanetary Society. I think with that background, you possibly have some opinion about the possibility of saucers being interplanetary.
Yes, I think it's only a matter of time before we're visited from space. In fact, I had an article in Harper's Magazine about 3 or 4 months ago called Where's Everybody, which was on this very theme. There are at least 100,000 million suns in this one universe of ours, and we're probably a pretty backward section of it. And we've only been civilized, if we are civilized, for a very short period of time. I'm sure there'll be thousands of civilizations out there among the stars with very much higher standards than ours, and they have space travel and interstellar travel. So it's certainly only a matter of time before we're visited.
Now, when you say, Mr. Clark, it's only a matter of time, are you implying that possibly they haven't arrived here yet?
I should think it's very probable they've arrived scores of times in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And it's even possible they've arrived in historic time. I mean, since there have been men who've recorded these things. I mean, some of Charles Fort's accounts are very hard to explain any other way except the arrival of spaceships in the Earth's atmosphere. But I don't think they're arriving now.
You don't think they're arriving now? When
no.
you say that, do you mean today?
Well, I mean, I don't think they've arrived.
Or during the last...
During the century, say.
During the century.
Mm-hmm.
You don't feel that any saucers... or UFOs have arrived here from other planets?
Of course, I can't prove this, but it's mm-hmm. my feeling that they haven't arrived. I mean,
if you feel that they have arrived here from time to time from other planets, why is it that they have stopped during the past century?
Well, I don't say they've stopped, but the problem is this. I suppose you have to conduct a survey of 100,000 million suns.
Mm-hmm.
You have only a limited number of survey ships. Well, it's a very rough estimate. You could probably only survey any one system every few thousand or few million years. And I should suggest that somewhere in some enormous central filing system there'll be a file on Earth with there's interesting information about it, a few thousand years out of date, saying that this planet may be worth visiting in, say, what might be the year 5000 A.D. to us. And they'll work around to us again sooner or later.
I'm a little speechless at this time. Charles?
Yes.
Well, are you going home?
I'm going to go look for this file card, to tell you the truth. The thing that curiosifies me is this. Why must they have come, say, in Paleolithic times, and why couldn't it have been, you know, 2 weeks ago last Monday that they brought the file card up to date?
Well, it could be any time. I'm just pointing out the statistics of it. Earth has been here for, let's say, 5 billion years. Take a nice round figure. Roughly 5 billion years.
We've been 4 billion.
Well, let's take the five. I like nice round numbers. 5 billion. We've been here, let's say, as a roughly civilized race for perhaps 5,000 years. One millionth of that total time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the chances of anything coming along in that period of time are fairly small. Now, as to why I don't think there are any visitors from space as of now, if somebody tells me they have seen a unicorn in Central Park, I say, very interesting. You may be right. If there really is a unicorn in Central Park, there will be no doubt whatsoever about the matter in a very short period of time. Similarly, if there really are spaceships hovering around this Earth, that is the sort of thing which will be settled as unequivocally as the existence of unicorns in Central Park in a very short period of time. To be tracked, photographed, observed in every possible way.
Well, Arthur, I personally do not buy the flying saucer thing, but I think there's an angle of motivation here. The unicorn in Central Park, I doubt, would much care whether or not he was established. But if our file keepers from Planet X want to do an anonymous survey, well, then they might, you know, very well keep out of the way most of the time, but they might slip a few times and a few gentlemen might see them.
Yes, but if they slipped at all, there wouldn't be much doubt about that. That's not the sort of thing that you can keep quiet. I mean, it's like the girl who said that her baby was a very small one. I mean, this is an all-or-nothing operation.
Sure enough. That I cannot fight.
Arthur Clark, on this program, I've had the pleasure and the opportunity of talking with a lot of people, and I would say I've spoken to at least 8 or 10 people who claim that they have had physical contact with Venusians and Martians, and if I'm not mistaken, 2 or possibly 3 of these people claim that they've been in saucers and they've visited other planets. How do you feel about those things, Mr. Clark?
Well, all these people who claim to have had physical contact and to have actually ridden in space vehicles,
mm-hmm.
they fall into 3 categories. Some of them are fooling you.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them really believe it and are insane. Others are possibly hoaxed by other people. Someone of rather simple intelligence may have been fooled by some unscrupulous friends who could possibly have kidded them into thinking they had met someone from a flying saucer. I'm sure that has happened occasionally.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd be interested to meet the man who could bring down this, you know, 60-foot pulsating object through the sky to fool some of these people.
Well,
this is the guy I want to get in contact with.
Well, I'm not discussing any particular case. I'm just generalized.
Cortland?
I take it that Mr. Clark feels an impossibility for somebody to have a physical contact. Is that right, Mr. Clark?
It's a possibility. It'll happen sooner or later. The point is, when it happens, there'll be no doubt about it.
Well, why do you say that?
Because this sort of thing does not happen in out-of-the-way places to obscure people.
Well, if you say it's never happened before, how can you make a statement that it won't happen in out-of-the-way places?
Because it'll happen, if it does happen even in an out-of-the-way place, that place will not remain out of the way very long.
Well, what would bring it in out of the way?
Pardon?
What would bring it in out of the way?
Well, listen, let's speak. Suppose that there is someone, say a reconnaissance group, surveying this planet, which, as I said, is quite possible, and I think ultimately is a certainty. Well, now, what will their procedure? If they're anthropologists, they'll make contact with people, and they'll work up from that. But the sort of reports we've had so far are so unconvincing and so trivial, and they're so contradictory. I don't see how you can possibly take any basis of seriousness in them.
Mr. Clark, I'm interested in the
statement that you just made, that you feel that the flying saucers would not contact an obscure person. Is that right, sir?
Oh, no, no. No? They wouldn't... for instance, the only reports I've said, well, the most of the people who have claimed to have made contact with flying saucers, the fact they're obscure has nothing to do with it. But they're, let's say, also peculiar, many of them. And I don't think you can deny that. Now, I'm not going to give any names, but I think you can fill in the blanks quite easily yourselves.
Well, no, I'd like to get back to... Didn't you use the word obscure?
I did use that word, and what I will ratify it. They might make contact, first of all, with, say, anybody they came up against. But you know that famous cartoon, Take Me to Your President?
Mm-hmm.
That's the sort of thing that will happen very soon after they have made contact with anybody.
I'm interested in your thinking on this, Mr. Clark. You made a statement a little while ago that you thought that possibly saucers or UFOs or spacecraft, that is, interplanetary craft, had arrived on this planet, but possibly not for the past 100 years. Now, if this is true, and let us say that 150 years ago, some interplanetary craft landed on this planet and they accidentally contacted an obscure person, don't you think that that person would have taken the Venusians or the Martians to somebody of importance so that we would have a record of it in our history?
I think that's very likely, and that is one of the best arguments against this happening in historic times. So you have fairly well convinced me that it hasn't happened for this reason. Your argument is a very sound one.
So we might as well wrap it up for a night.
No, that would be most disappointing. We can go back to, say, about 2000 BC, and then... What would have happened? It would have been lost. I mean, the whole historical...
That's true.
Well, the point is, there's very...
It hasn't been, actually.
Yes, but there's very little point in discussing these cases because you can never prove them one way or the other, the early cases. They can never be proved. You can argue around them until kingdom come. And there's no way that I can see, unless you make a time machine, of proving that that really was an extraterrestrial contact. So we are really stuck with the modern sightings if we want to do anything.
Mm-hmm. Cortland?
As long as we're back to 2000 BC, which is a rather interesting and round date.
I like round figures.
Sure. A friend of mine is an Egyptologist, and he's been doing quite a bit of study in that. And he says that in the Book of the Dead, there are numerous references to spaceships or machines from space. There is some reference to sun, and some people say that these are suns. But in the next paragraphs or so, it will be mentioned that these machines blot out the sun. And there are numerous references to the pharaohs going out to have conversations with these people as being those beings from outer space of greater wisdom than our own.
Well, I mean, I could match dozens of these cases from... you can take things in the Bible. I mean, you can prove thousands of cases, quite convincing, but you could... Not prove them, but you can build up some very interesting cases. But you can never prove them or disprove them, so really there's not much we can do on the matter.
The thing that, surprises me is that so much credence is attached to Egyptian mythology. Why not go into Norse mythology and talk about Valhalla and the ice gods and so forth as being, who knows, maybe frozen flying saucers? What is so much with Egypt and the Book of the Dead? This is what I don't understand.
Well, some very good cases in the Ceylonese mythology. I happen to live in Ceylon now, and there are cases in the sacred writings of Ceylon going back to about 500 B.C., where there are stories of flying machines and so on, which are quite convincing.
Well, the Book of the Dead is an extremely important book. It happens to be one of the bases. That's why I was referred to. I'd like to go back, however, to the point of actual contact here of much more contemporary nature than 2000 B.C. That is a little bit long. I would like to mention, or go back, say, to 1947, in which Army Air Force intelligence officers had been investigating reports of unidentified flying objects at very high speeds in various sections of the United States. And on September 23rd, in fact, on July 8th, the Air Corps statement at the Pentagon is, and I quote, "We are investigating a flying disc report by Navy rocket engineer C.T. Zone and three other rocket scientists." Now, we assume that these rocket scientists would know a UFO from something with which they were familiar. And on September 23rd of 1947, the official analysis report from the Air Technical Intelligence Center, that's where we investigate these things, Mr. Clark, out at the Air Force base in Dayton, Ohio, to General Hoyt Vandenberg, who incidentally was a friend of my superiors and a very close one, commanding general at that time of the Army Air Corps, and I quote, "The reported phenomena are real," end quote. Now, there is no question there as to what they're thinking. Those words are incisive.
I think there's a great deal of question as to what they're thinking. They say the reported phenomena are real, end quotes, and anything beyond that is what you read into it and is subject to a lot of question.
They mean that they are real, that they are not anything that we have, Charles, and that they obviously are coming from outer space.
Portland, how do you know what they mean?
Because I am about to read 1948.
Good, this is what I would like to know.
You did that great. That was a good production.
Thanks, Charles. You're a good end man here.
Yeah, you're a good middleman, too, Gordon.
The Air Corps in 1948, July 24th, a statement by General George C. Kenney, who was at that time chief of the Strategic Air Command, after the so-called spaceship sighting by the pilots and a passenger of an Eastern Airlines plane, stated, "We're completely mystified. We have nothing remotely like the machine described. I wish we did," end quote.
That doesn't mean that they're interplanetary, though, Clark. They may be from a foreign government.
It doesn't even mean they're machines.
It says we have nothing remotely like what was described by the witnesses, which means absolutely nothing to me.
In August, the date was withheld, but a top secret estimate of the situation by the Air Technical Intelligence Center, later declassified but never released, stated that flying saucers were interplanetary spaceships.
What was that again?
Flying saucers.
Now, who said that?
A top secret estimate of the situation. This is a document.
Declassified,
but not really.
Do you realize that recently, I think it was just today, they was declassified a document on the use of bows and arrows in warfare, which was classified by mistake, Mr. Hastings? A lot of this top secret classified secret estimate, which may have been by a corporal and a demented corporal at that, is not very impressive.
I'm not trying to impress by whether it was classified or declassified.
Oh, I see. What is the impressive part?
It was never released.
What is the impressive part of this statement? We've been leading up with my end man bit here for 5 minutes to this statement. Now, what is the impressive part of it?
Well, I guess I don't speak good English. It said the flying saucers were interplanetary spaceships.
And this, as far as I know, this was made by a demented corporal at Dayton, Ohio. Now, how do you know any different?
No, it was made by a rather higher level than that. It was made by a number of quite competent authorities who had access to the information and who came to this conclusion, as I think many reasonable men would do, if their knowledge of atmospheric optics and natural phenomena was not complete.
Then you're trying to go along with Dr. Menzel of Harvard.
Oh, no, I don't go in along entirely with him, but most of the confusion in this subject is caused by mixing up two entirely separate things. One, UFOs. I think UFOs probably exist. And the other, so-called flying saucers, which are our vehicles, definite vehicles, which are a totally different thing, and which don't exist.
Flying saucers are different from UFOs, and according to your opinion, Mr. Clark, flying saucers do not exist, but there's a great possibility that UFOs do.
I would say that there's a 99% possibility that UFOs do exist, and only a 1% possibility that flying saucers as interplanetary vehicles exist.
Well, Mr. Clark, I wonder if you could tell me what a UFO is.
Well, let me go back to this report of these gentlemen who decided.
The one that Cortland
decided, in view of the fact, these reports and this evidence, that
These things were really interplanetary vehicles. This is a conclusion I came to myself about that time as a result of these reports. And it wasn't until I'd seen about six UFOs myself that I decided that I realized they were not spaceships. The point is that there are far more fantastic things in the sky than anybody realizes, even the trained observer who spends a lot of time looking at the sky. And I don't see how anyone hearing all these reports and not seeing them could really fail to think they were spaceships. But they're not spaceships when you were to analyze the evidence. Now, let me give my reasons for thinking this. First of all, I say I heard all these reports, these sightings, made by competent people. And, I mean, you couldn't say they were all lying. And they were very convincing and very extraordinary and very inexplicable. And then, as I travel around the world, I've been around the world a couple of times in the last 5 years, I saw quite a few strange things. And I have now seen, I've just been listing them, I have seen six UFOs. By that I mean objects which were quite inexplicable when I saw them, which could easily have been interpreted as spaceships, which took a lot of explaining, and often the explanations were so fantastic I almost hesitate to give them. But in every case I was able to find out what they were. But I'm sure that 99% of people who'd seen them would have decided they were spaceships, but they were not. But this is happening all the time. Now, can I give some examples of things I saw to show you what I mean?
Please do.
Well, I was in London one day, on bright summer's day, somewhere near Regent Street, and I saw a lot of people looking up at the sky. And I looked up too, and there, a long way up, were two black spheres close together, quite motionless in the sky. There was a very strong wind blowing at the time, and these two black discs or spheres just were absolutely motionless over the center of London. I will come back to this in a minute. I'll go on to my next sighting. I was in Brisbane, Australia, on my first underwater expedition to the Great Barrier Reef, and one evening, I was in a building about five or six floors up, looking out towards the sunset, and I saw, to my astonishment, a whole string of brilliant silver discs, roughly elliptical, flip-flopping across the horizon quite slowly with a curious oscillating movement. And I said, good heavens, this is it, you see. And I watched them go right across the sky, and this was absolutely convincing, these oscillating silver discs moving slowly. Well, that was a second case. I'll give you a third case before I come back to the earlier two, if you don't mind me taking so much of your time. Again, I was in Australia, in Sydney, and I saw an extraordinarily shaped cloud. It looked like a cloud, except it had rather solid edges, hanging above the city of Sydney. And this, again, was a strong wind blowing, and this cloud stayed in the same place and slightly altered its shape, but it looked like an amoeba. It was hanging over Sydney, and despite the fact there was a very strong wind blowing. But I've given these three things, and I'd like to know if you... I'll tell you, can you explain them? I'll tell you what they were in a minute, but these are the things I saw. I've described them as carefully as I can.
Would you care to try?
The two black discs in a high wind of motionless over the middle of London, the string of silver ellipses flip-flopping across the sky along the horizon, and this weird amoeba-shaped cloud, motionless in a high wind over the middle of the great city.
No, these sound like regular descriptions.
Quite well,
fine sausage.
And I mean,
I'd like to hear what you.
If anyone had told me they had seen these things, I would have been forced to accept them as inexplicable flying saucers, perhaps some kind of artifact. Well, the first one was an artifact. The two black discs close together, high over London. If I hadn't gone to Regent's Park, I wouldn't have found out what it was. It was a kid flying a very large box kite that must have been about a mile up. But it was so high that its structure was... you couldn't see what it was, and of course you don't associate kite flying in the middle of London, but it was a box kite at such a height that it looked like two black spots side by side over the middle of London.
Was
I went to Regent's Park and saw the kid flying it.
You saw the...
But it was a high... I'd never seen a kite so high. I mean, I say about a mile up, that's a rough guess, but you could not tell it was a kite because it was so high. Now, this is, you may say, is a simple case, but this is the sort of thing that can start reports, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm almost ashamed to tell you what the flipping discs were. Because this sounds so trite, and I had read this in books, and I had not believed it. They were seagulls catching the setting sun. Now, listen, before you laugh at me, I was born by the sea. I have lived by the sea nearly all my life. I live by the sea now. I have seen seagulls a million times, but only once in my life have I seen this phenomenon. Under certain conditions of illumination with a low sun, seagulls and other birds produce an absolutely convincing impression of metallic discs moving, oscillating across the sky. That was what this was. Now, the third case, this amoeba-shaped cloud, motionless over a city in a high wind, slowly changing its shape. It was a weird thing. It really sort of gave me creeps. I had to get a pair of binoculars to find out what it was. And there was a chemical plant of some kind with a high chimney, which I couldn't see, and something, some fumes, I don't know what they were coming out of this chimney. You couldn't see them when they left the chimney, as you can't see the smoke, as you often can't see the steam from a kettle. And it was obviously condensing a little way downwind of the chimney and then being dispersed. So it was roughly motionless in space, despite the wind, and it was slowly changing its shape. It was an artificial cloud, a byproduct of this chemical factory. But all these three cases are just examples of some of the extraordinary things that I myself have seen in a few years in the sky. And this is why I don't take seriously any report of anything seen in the sky. I'm sure that people see these things, they can't interpret it.
Arthur, you mentioned UFOs and flying saucers. You believe in UFOs and you don't believe in flying saucers. Isn't it possible that because you have never seen a flying saucer, or at least to your knowledge, you don't know that you saw an interplanetary craft? I call them flying saucers because it's convenient on this program. If you've never seen one, and yet you believe in UFOs, isn't it possible for a person to see a flying saucer and not being familiar with its shape or the anything about it, that they could be considered to be UFOs?
Of course, it's perfectly possible. When there's so many hundreds of explanations of strange things, why on earth bring in an unearthly explanation until you've exhausted all the terrestrial ones?
We've talked on this program to a few members of an organization that's called CSI, that's Civilian Saucer Intelligence. It's located in the city of New York. And I might say that the few people that I've had the pleasure of meeting who are members of that organization are certainly brilliant, intelligent people, people that have excellent educational backgrounds, people like Lex Nevin, Ted Blocher, Ivan Sanderson. These names may mean nothing to you at all.
Oh,
you know Ivan. I heard recently, not from these gentlemen, but from other people, and so far no one has denied it, that a few of these people, not all of the names that I've mentioned, but a few of them, believe in little men, not green ones now. In other words, actually, it's been thrown out on this program by somebody that these men believe in little green men. Now, that has been corrected, not by Mr. Mevin or Mr. Blocher, but we've had people who said it isn't green one. They don't even know what the colors may be. But due to extensive research on the part of one or two members of Civilian Saucer Intelligence, these people now sort of lean in the direction of the little men visiting this planet. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's nonsense. I mean, there's no evidence for these things, and why bring them in until you've eliminated all the other possibilities?
Mm-hmm. Court?
I don't think that...
You're almost speechless at this moment.
Oh, no, I'm not. I'm just waiting patiently.
I see.
I'm sorry if I've been monopolizing.
Not at all. Arthur, this program here, you're liable to go for an hour without stopping. That's the way we work this program. Go
Frankly,
ahead.
I think Mr. Clark is to be complimented on his examining into the what he saw.
I agree with you.
I am all for that. I think there is too little of it. We need more of it. But I don't think that what your experience, Mr. Clark, is any indication of the grand total.
I have seen things, too, which looked like saucers. I didn't think so, but I wasn't sure. But in a few minutes, I determined very definitely that there had to be much more solidity to what I saw to prove to me that they were saucers. And I have never seen one, yet. As far as the little men go, I'm sure Ivan Sanderson feels quite convinced in his own mind after having gone down to the, wherever that blooming place was, where the landing was supposed to have been.
Are you talking about the West Virginia Monster?
Well, he went down that Flatwoods,
yes.
West
yes,
Virginia.
Flatwoods, yeah. West Virginia.
Yeah, but that wasn't,
that wasn't a little
that
man.
That wasn't a little man.
No.
I was just trying to think of the location, but I don't feel so bad, Long John, as long as your memory, which is as long as an elephant, can't remember where it was. I don't feel so bad.
I may have made a mistake here. Ivan Sanderson is not Hans Stefansson, the...
No, not Hans Stefansson.
Ivan Sanderson is the zoologist.
Oh, I don't know
him. Hans Stefan Sanderson is the editorial director of Fantastic.
Yes, I know Hans quite well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Ivan is a very bright chap and very well grounded. And I heard him give a dissertation one evening on these little men. As far as I'm concerned, I put it aside because I don't know whether there are or not. I certainly would credit Ivan's intelligence quite considerably because when he goes after something, he's a bit skeptical on these things. Let's say he's very skeptical about them. However, what I wanted to get back to is to some of these. If Mr. Clark feels that there are no saucers which have been around lately, I would like to just bring out a whole battery of instances here, not consecutively, because after all, that would be taking too much time. But on November 3rd, I presume you're aware, Mr. Clark, that there were quite a concentration of sightings. They started, actually, on November 2nd. On November 2nd, the owner of station KCLV in New Mexico saw a strange glowing object speeding southeast. Now, he could have been mistaken, no question. But the Ground Observer Corps at Midland, Texas, saw the object flying west at a low altitude. And that same evening, Civilian Aeronautics Association, is that correct, Wayne? You're up on that CAA. Tower operators on duty at the Amarillo Airport base sighted a peculiar bluish object moving through the sky. And one of the tower operators, whose business it is to know these things, said he had never seen anything so spectacular. Well, that's another one. Now, however, we get to the things that are going to be more concrete and where we can really sink some teeth in. At 1:30 on November 3rd, on a Sunday, a huge oval-shaped object was reported as landing, or very closely approaching trucks, on a highway in Levelland, Texas, or right outside of Levelland, Texas. Now, the sheriff investigated these cases, and in three of them, the close passage of the UFO had stopped the car engines and dimmed or put out the headlights. Now, two other men, Clem himself, the sheriff, and his deputy sheriff, saw the glow from the object themselves as it crossed above the highway and brilliantly lighted up the pavement. And this light was seen by two other patrolmen, each following in a separate car. Now, would you care to comment on that before I go into some others?
Yes.
They saw the object as 125 to 200 feet in diameter, I might add.
Well, now, this falls down to a number of separate categories. First of all, the sightings, objects seen in the sky, those are quite different from what I was talking about in flying saucers and vehicles. They're what I call the UFOs, and many of those may be an unexplained UFO. I'd like to come back to that later. But before, let me recapitulate. Anything strange seen in the sky, not close enough to get you to give an idea of its structure, that may have many hundreds of separate explanations, and I think there may be a residue which has no explanation yet. You can call this a genuine UFO, which may turn out to be quite a new phenomenon. I have some ideas on that I'd like to come to later. But as for the reports of things that land and come down to Earth, people see things coming out of them, I just do not believe any of those. And this one you have just quoted, contains the seeds of his own disproof. The story of the car engine stopping, because this brings me right back to 1937. In 1937, 1938, car engines were stopping all over England. They were stopping near the big towers that were being put up along the East Coast, because those towers were supposed to contain a ray, to generate a ray, which would stop the engines of the Luftwaffe when they bombed England. And this report, every week you were hearing about car engines being stopped. Everybody believed this, quite genuinely, that car engines were being stopped. This was absolute nonsense. They were radar stations, and the car engine reports were being put out by counterintelligence to make people think that this is what these stations really were, that they were to stop the Luftwaffe's engines. There was no truth whatsoever in these reports, but this was a universal belief. So whenever I hear about car engines stopping, I remember the same thing 20 years ago, and there was not a word of truth in it.
Well, do you feel then that it's possible that our government are putting out these false rumors?
There's no need to make false rumors, but no need to put them out.
Well, these had nothing to do with radar towers, Mr. Clark.
No, but this is a beautiful example of the sort of hysteria that generates. Someone starts the story, and quite possibly someone sees something and they stole their engine. And then that starts the whole thing.
And then they put out the headlights, too.
Sure. They probably pulled the ignition out.
Well, we'll have to go to another one where there are a great many more cars involved.
Well, before we do that, let me take a moment to do a little piece of business. I think you wanted to get into a little different line.
Yeah, I was, now that we proved that flying saucers don't exist, I thought, one point, Arthur, in your lecture the other night at the New York Center, you said something about satellites. You said quite a lot about satellites, for that matter. But one thing was, I recall you saying that if the Russians on that satellite had used, instead of the on the second satellite, instead of the big dog bearing thing,
yeah,
if they had put a fourth stage on there,
yes,
they could have hit the moon. Is that
yes, they could have landed. They could have hit the moon with a payload of about 50 pounds, maybe 100 pounds.
Why would they? Having got one satellite up already, I don't know whether the second one was really for scientific research or what, but it certainly would have been a great deal more impressive if they had done a magnesium flare or whatever they're going to do to mark the moon.
Well, what they did with Sputnik 2 was much more useful scientifically. That was loaded with instruments, and of course, as well as a dog, and they obtained a vast amount of scientific information from that flight. So that was the obvious next one to do after Sputnik 1, to do the heavier payload in the orbit. I would say the logical thing now for the next one is an attempt to shoot something around the moon. They can do it any time they feel like it, but I'm rather surprised they haven't already.
What value would it be for any country to be able to land on the moon?
What value would it to land on America? The moon is much bigger than America, and after all, the moon is only the stepping stone to the other planets and to the universe as a whole.
Do you think it would be of any value to us in the event of war as a nation?
No, I don't think so. We can destroy ourselves completely adequately with existing weapons on this planet. There's no need to go into space to set up military bases.
I agree with Mr. Clark. First time this evening. It's a pleasure, sir.
If we want to use the moon for any military purpose, I suggest we build our air raid shelters there.
What? I wanted to get back to this other little corroborating instance, because I frankly, Mr. Clark, with due deference to your scientific knowledge, which is vastly in excess of mine, I wanted to point out another sighting, however, of a UFO by a research engineer of the Air Force Missile Development Center near Alamogordo.